Welcome to the Joe Thomas in the Morning podcast, where we take highlights of the morning program on WCHV Radio in Charlottesville, Virginia, the second greatest city in the history of mankind. You can debate me if you want, and I will stick up for her. That said, you may have missed some parts of the morning program. Sometimes I can't even listen for all 4 hours, and I'm the host. But that's okay. We put this together so you can go back in time, find things in context, and put together for you here on the podcast channel of WCHV.com.
Being tuned in means
some schools are close to a year-round schedule. Good idea.
Seville 107.5 and 1260 WCHV.
You can't always get what you want.
I get this email from the Bear. Does Dr. Hansen realize that what rarefied air he's operating in with being with Hannity last night and topping with you now? I don't know how you call her these guys, but I love this guy. Joining us now, best-selling author and military historian from the Hoover Institute, doctor, professor, and just all-around awesome thinker, Victor Davis Hansen. Good morning, Victor. How are you, sir?
Very good. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. Thank you for taking time. When did the impetus of this book first strike you?
Well, it was right after he got elected, because I thought there was a lot of misinformation. There was either he was a saint or a sinner, but few people just analyzed how a person without either political or military experience had defeated 16 candidates. And then how did, against all the polls and professional judgment, win the presidency against Hillary Clinton, that had all of the media and the establishment and 2.5 times more money? How did he win? And then how did he defy expectations by having a pretty good presidency for the first 2.25 years, in spite of these efforts to the Mueller investigation, the Emoluments Act allegation, the 25th Amendment, all of these efforts to destroy his presidency? And finally, what was it about him or his agenda that made people hate him so much?
Well, is it?
I tried to analyze that.
Is it people, or is it the people we've always sort of turned to dictate to us what our opinions need to be, the media-centric? Because it seemed like one of the tactics the president used, both in the campaign and now, is this avoidance of the traditional conduit of connection, his rallies, as close to a door-to-door campaign nationwide as I could imagine. These rallies often were the fulcrum of the idea of fake news, because people would go to the rally, then read about it the next day in the paper and say, that's not anything like what went on at the rally. And it started to really begin to convince people that what they were reading in the newspaper or watching on the evening news wasn't necessarily what really happened.
I think it was all of that. I think the Republican establishment, but the media establishment and the political establishment assumed that every Republican nominee, a Bob Dole, John McCain, or Mitt Romney, would act and talk and comport themselves in a way that they approved of and would have the necessary background. And when Trump came along, he was so written off that he was alienated. And then when he won, he used some of them, but he didn't call them up. He didn't call the Weekly Standard, National Review, commentary, and say, hey, I need some wise men to advise me. He didn't call the Council on Foreign Relations, Brookings Institute, et cetera. He didn't call past presidents. Hey, Bill Clinton. Hey, George, give me some advice.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think that bothered people. And then they couldn't square the circle that he got 3% annualized growth, record peacetime unemployment in the last 70 years, energy production, deregulation, good judges, but he had not gone to Harvard Business School, Yale Law School, Harvard Law School. He didn't speak a particular way. He didn't look a particular way. And it became for them a referendum on their own resumes. If we have the best resumes, but we didn't do as well as he did, what does that say about the value of a resume?
Does that lead them to believe that he had to have cheated to get it? I think this is part, at least in my observation, I'm really curious about yours. We're visiting with Victor Davis Hansen, the author of The Case for Trump, which is at essence to this zeal with a lot of the folks in the media that he had to have cheated. Russia had to have helped him. Foreign governments had to have helped him. He had to have, you know, had unseen and collusive help, because otherwise it blows up their whole worldview if somebody can just come from outside and do this.
I think that's true. But in the book, I kind of pointed out that they didn't believe that until he won. In fact, Barack Obama gave a speech 3 weeks before the election, said you can't, even if Trump wanted to, you can't change an election. We have so many bulletproof barriers to Russian collusion, and he better quit whining. He was whining in Hillary's emails. He better quit whining and go out there, and because they all knew he was going to lose, they thought.
Oh, sure.
So this idea that he cheated, it only came really within 24 hours after the election. They had the Steele dossier not to destroy his presidency. They didn't think it would ever exist. They had it because they wanted to run up a landslide, a mandate, an insurance policy, leak all of these false stories to the media, which they did before the election. And then after the election, for the first time, they went back and looked at that dossier and said, you know what, now it's valuable to undermine his transition, to get three more FISA warrants, to unmask. That period between November and January 20th, when Trump took over, was just frenzied activity on the part of the Obama administration to get out as much salacious detail, to leak as much from FISA warrants, to try to demonize Michael Flynn. That's where that fury came, that he won. And then they developed this narrative that he cheated. But before he won, they didn't think he cheated at all. They thought he was a buffoon. He was too stupid, they thought, to cheat. And Clapper and Comey and McCabe and Brennan and Becky and all those people, Sally Yates, they would have all been praised by President Hillary Clinton. They would have come to her and said, you know what? We signed FISA warrants, and we didn't tell the judges that you paid for this Steele dossier. Or they would have said, we wouldn't put an informant in Trump's campaign. Or, you know what? We unmasked names of those who were surveilled and leaked them to Yahoo News. We did a lot for you. We want a better job. And that's we would have not known any of it. We won.
You know, what's interesting about the FISA warrants, and as somebody who studies tactics, I want to get your thought on that and a couple other things. Victor Davis Hanson, I'm told we're up to... Oh, look at that. Yeah, it's time for the news. We'll be right back. Victor Davis Hanson, hang on the Newsmakers line with me.
I'm CBS 19 Chief Meteorologist Travis Koshko for Seaville 107.5 and 1260 WCHV.
WCHV time, 7:37.
Make America great again. Make America great again.
Victor Davis Hanson, I've got two questions. I don't know how quickly we can answer them, and we're under no time constraints. So, but there are two that strike me as essential to the next 2 years and perhaps the four after that. The president's popularity growing in the black community and in areas where traditionally the Democrats have lived. First, is that key to why they're so passionately trying to drag him down? And second part of that first question is there a lesson that the Republican / conservative people should be learning from that, in your view, from where you sit at the Hoover Institute and as somebody who's been a chronicler of these historical moments?
Yeah, I'm speaking from my farmhouse in Selma, California, San Joaquin Valley, which is mostly Hispanic neighborhood. And the change in job opportunity is amazing. And what Trump was trying to do was substitute race, class for race. And what I mean by that is he thought if he could get a 3% GDP and record low minority unemployment, then a job is central to a person's existence. And he could say to a person, once you're in the driver's seat and employers have to come to you rather than you have to fight other job workers, whether they're illegal or not, for a job, then you're going to have a greater sense of self, confidence, people around you are going to be happier. And a lot of these problems in the country, identity politics, animosities, crime, are going to start to wither away if we can just get you guys jobs and give you a sense that you're on the right trajectory. And he did that. And that made the Democrats very scared because they had so alienated the white working class. 62, 63, 64% of white males always vote against Democrats. And that's the white population is still 70% of the electorate. And so what he's saying to the Democratic Party is you can't afford to lose 40% of the Hispanics or 20% of the African Americans, because you have so lost people who are tired of this progressive white supremacy, white privilege, these charges that are leveled against the white working class who have no white privilege,
yeah,
at least compared to the people who are charging them with it, mm-hmm, you know, live in Malibu and Atherton and Greenwich. So I think that caused the hysteria, that Trump basically, like a proverbial fox, went into the hen house, both in the Midwest, and poached the Democratic union worker from the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And then now he's starting to go into states like Colorado and Nevada that can't afford to lose 40% of the Hispanic vote. The Democrats can't. And in a state like Michigan or Virginia that have about 250,000 Hispanic voters, mm-hmm, which he could win those states just, wow, by the Hispanic vote not being 80-90% against him.
Yeah.
That's his plan. I think it's a good plan. He needs to really double down on it.
Well, it certainly reminds me of 1984 when, you know, it seemed, I think there was only one state that didn't vote for Reagan electorally, and it was Bob Dole's home state. Not Bob Dole, the guy.
Walter Mondale.
Yeah. Second question, and it has to really do with President Bush 41 more than anything else. But it has to do with Trump and his attitude towards NATO and the UN and international, China, Russia, etc., is that when President Bush left office and he and Brent Scowcroft wrote The World Transformed, and it was about the New World Order and the Soviet Union had collapsed, I got the impression they were talking about a world that understood the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights and said, we want to live like that. What's transpired since then is a place where it is a planet that seems to say, okay, you had your two-century-long flirtation with this, you know, citizen-led government. Now join the rest of us and understand that there has to be a ruling elite in order for an ordered society. And I feel like that's kind of where we are right now, as we're teetering on becoming just like all the other, you know, global European style, the ruling elites tell the rest of the masses. I hear them talk about eliminating the Electoral College at the same time of telling us we were too dumb to identify Russian fake websites telling us to vote one way or another, and making the case that this is why New York and L.A. and Chicago should pick all our presidents. Is this a flashpoint in history where if the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights, however much we still live by it today, is going to survive, we need to push back against the idea that it was a cute little experiment for a couple of hundred years, but, you know, it really is just a blip in history rather than something that really could be paradigm shifting in people's liberty?
Yeah, I think it is. I think people in Silicon Valley had more allegiance to Tokyo and Shanghai than they did Bakersfield or Fresno. And then people in Wall Street had more allegiance to London or Paris or Hamburg than they did York, Pennsylvania. And by that, I mean, they were trying to tell the deplorables and the irredeemables, hey, when we go abroad, we see solar panels and we see clean airports, but we also see, we don't see crazy people with guns. They don't have a Second Amendment, mm-hmm, or they have abortion on demand. They have infanticide. They have euthanasia.
Mm-hmm.
They have radical government green programs that take away private property, or they don't allow referenda to be standing, or they don't really believe in the First Amendment because it encourages hate speech. So they were telling us, hey, you guys in the middle of the country, we're abroad where all the wealth and power is, and the Chinese and the EU and Japan and Korea, they have different paradigms, and it's time for us to be more like them than them like us. And one of the things, you know, and so the middle of the country said, you know what, I don't believe in partial birth abortion. I don't believe that you can restrict free speech. I don't believe you have a right to take away my constitutionally protected firearm. I don't believe that due process and the Fifth Amendment should be banned from campus. I don't believe
private property.
That free trade is fair trade. And so, yeah, it is a pushback. And the funny thing about it is, it's starting to get adherence in the Yellow Vest in France and,
yep,
the Brexit movement, and Eastern Europeans push back against Germany, and Southern Europeans push back against Frankfurt, Germany, and the financiers. So it's a worldwide populist pushback and says, you know what, the nation state and difference is really what protects freedom, and transnational conglomerations of bureaucrats that are unelected destroy freedom, and we don't want a part of it. And that's why they hate Trump so much, I think, especially in this country.
Yeah, and
because if he succeeds, their power will be sorely diminished.
I grew up in New York City, Professor Hansen, and I've been watching Donald Trump since the first day he walked out in front of a TV camera and said, I'd like to build a building here and hire 5,000 New Yorkers to build it. I don't know why Ed Koch isn't, you know, with me on it. And he really is the same guy he was then as well. But I know this much. He's never been the guy everyone's warned you about. If you let Trump do this, then fill in the blank, something horrible will happen. He's never been that guy. And equally, nobody's ever gone back and said, hey, you know, we got it wrong. All those horrible things didn't happen. So I imagine that we'll be visiting again soon with more books for you. What is next for you as you continue, or are you just going to kind of, you know, work this book for a while, or do you have anything else in mind coming?
Well, the publisher wants me to update it right before the election for the paperback, and I'll do that. But I'm also the topic that we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the global elite throughout history, and the administrative permanent state and its role in decline and destruction of culture.
Wow.
Because I really do believe that. I think that when you get these administrative permanent bureaucracies, whether in Rome or Byzantium or here, they lose their sense of national loyalty, and they view empire as preferable to the republic, and they're very pernicious throughout history.
Yeah, I'll line up to buy the first copy of that if when you're done with it, sir. I do deeply appreciate your time, and thank you so much for spending it with us. Moreover, writing the book as well, The Case for Trump. It's at victorhansen.com, Amazon, at Barnes & Noble if they haven't buried it on the cutout bin yet. But I do deeply appreciate your time, as always, in all of the books you've written. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.